It is hard not to get angry when we see how the world is going today. As Christians, we know what the truth is. We know what right and wrong are. We know how people ought to live their lives, that they ought to be living as married couples, how they ought to live as parents, how we ought to pursue holiness and truth. We know that God has made us, that He ought to be acknowledged and worshipped. We know what the laws of the land ought to be when it comes to things like homosexual marriage, abortion, and euthanasia. But what are we seeing? It's very easy for us to get angry at times like these. The Christianity that used to shape our society is now marginalized. Worse than that, in fact, Christianity is the problem. Christianity is now the thing that is being blamed for all that it has done in the past, and it is aggressively rejected. In fact, anyone who associates with Christianity is public enemy number one and part of the problem, not part of the solution. On top of that, we are all seeing what's going on in society. We're seeing big government, big education, big pharma, big business, big tech, big social media, big mainstream media, big Hollywood, big sports, all leaning in a leftist direction. We are seeing the influence of critical race theory, transgender ideology, soft and hard forms of communism, and many other insidious ideas take over the voices that are heard in the public square. And worse than that, they're after our children. It's very hard not to get angry in a world like ours. I'm sure you can feel that temptation to anger all the time. And what is our response? What ought our response to be? Christian responses have often been anger, anxiety, or activism. These have been the three typical responses, not of faith, but that instinctive response. If we look at the responses of those who are not believers, who might have some of the views that we have in common with us, those who do not know God, who do not have our hope, their response will, of course, be very different to ours. What are we seeing in the public square in the world today? We're witnessing a storm of views as the left and the right collide. The left is demonizing and denouncing the right and vice versa. The personal venom and animosity is tangible. Aggressive tribalism and a polarity of views is the new normal. People are ready to be triggered whenever they go out in public, just waiting for you to affirm a confirmation bias that you are in fact that problematic extremist, which is the problem with the world today. People are waiting to be triggered. They just want to hear that you are all the worse of what they feared, and they'll just put you in that box and write you off. Public discourse is degraded into mudslinging. Thoughtful critique of a person's opinions have given way to ad hominem attacks. That means at the man. And this is infecting the church. That's the way the world's responding. But too often, Christians are responding in kind. They are angry. They are anxious, and they are turning to activism in the same way in which the world is. The believer is living in the same world. They're watching the same news, listening to the same social commentators, having their hearts stirred by the same influences. And we're seeing Christians make stupid responses. We're seeing things like the rise of Christian nationalism. Christianity is being seen as a political tool that needs to be implemented at the national and political level. To stop culture from drifting from its one Christian roots, we need to make New Zealand Christian again. We need to make America great again. We need to get back to the faith of the founding fathers and make it all Christian again. You've probably heard it over and over in different forms. We're seeing, on top of that, an increasing amount of young men who are angry, who are anxious, who are wanting to do something. They're being attracted to the likes of theonomy and postmillennialism. If you go online and you listen for the Christian voices that are speaking out into this cultural moment, who are critiquing the things that are going wrong and calling for action, who are those who are making the most noise? People like Doug Wilson, Jeff Durbin, James White, who has recently abandoned his amillennialism for postmillennialism. And they are mediating the theology of people like Rush Dooney and Greg Barnson as this new reconstructionist, this new theonomist, this new postmillennial wave is seeking to rise up in the name of the culture wars to make the Christian, the public square Christian again. They believe that the Mosaic law should be instituted, and they're offering in their theology a golden era of Christ reigning on the earth where you could once again live in a Christian culture where Christian laws are ruling the land. All you have to do is go out, preach the gospel, and as soon as we hit the 51% majority mark, we can vote in all our Christian laws, and we can have our golden post-millennial era. They are exploiting the times that we are living in. They're using the obvious wrongs of society to promote the supposed solutions of their own errors, pretending that their idealistic postmillennialism is what the world needs now to fix all the cultural problems. People are buying it. Because Christians are angry, because they're anxious, because they're earnest to do something, they're willing to climb into bed with those whose theology is wrong. They're desperate. And so there's all of the Christians are making for very strange bedfellows. They're climbing into bed with all sorts of wrong types of groups and people because they're so anxious about what's going on in the world and want to see something happen. What does the Bible say about all this? That's what we hear in Psalm 37. For Psalm 37 has, for me, it's a word in season for the situation that we're facing in the world today. It's a commentary on what Christ meant when he said in Matthew 5, verse 5, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." The earth is the thing we're concerned about. God's will being done on earth as it is in heaven. That's what we pray in the Lord's Prayer. Jesus promises us a time when the earth will be under the will of God, and the meek will inherit that earth. We want to know when and how that's all going to happen. Now, we know that Jesus in Matthew 5, verse 5, is, of course, quoting from Psalm 37, verse 11. If you look down at Psalm 37, 11, it says, "But the meek shall inherit the land and delight themselves in abundant peace." Jesus takes the inherit the land, referring to Israel, and he expands it to inherit the earth. Christ is alerting us to the fact that Israel is a type that is pointing to something beyond itself, namely the new creation, the new heavens and the new earth. And that is the time that is being pointed forward to through these types. Last week, we looked at Psalm 77, where we looked at God's past faithfulness to manage our emotions of anxiety and depression, those emotions that overwhelm us. Well, today, we're doing the opposite. We're looking at Psalm 37, verse 1 to 11. We're going to be looking at God's future faithfulness to help us manage the anger and the anxiety that overwhelms us when evil seems to be prospering all around us. So we're going to be looking at four actions as an outline for our text, all in relation to God. Trust in the Lord, delight yourself in the Lord, commit your ways to the Lord, be still before the Lord. So read with me again verses 1 and 2. "Fret not yourself because of evildoers. Be not envious of wrongdoers, for they will soon fade like the grass and wither like the green herb." Our psalm begins with a call against the anger, which is our first temptation. You want to be angry. We are righteously angry, aren't we? We feel like we've got to be indignant. But the psalm calls us not to be governed by anger and then quickly gives us a reason. We will all live happily ever after. That's the reason. Don't be angry. We will all live happily ever after. Just all injustice, all evil will be put away. Doesn't that just sound so simple? Sounds very simple, doesn't it? Don't be angry, it'll all be okay. But this, of course, is not the trite comforting of a Hallmark card, but deep and profound theology. And the rest of the psalm will be justifying this opening statement. It's going to be opening up why we need not be angry, and why our future is secure, and why evil will not finally triumph. We won't be looking at the whole psalm, but there are a few things that we can note about the psalm before we dig into our first 11 verses. So a few comments about the psalm before we begin. Firstly, the psalm is an acrostic psalm. What does acrostic mean? It's when you have a poem where the first letter, the first line starts with A, the second line starts with B, the third line starts with C. This is an acrostic psalm. Now, why is that important? It's important because when you have an acrostic psalm, the structure of the psalm is not necessarily governed by logic. It's not necessarily governed by a strict chronology. And so the author of this psalm is not concerned with a logical flow as much as just repeating themes over and over again. And I raise that point because as a preacher, that really annoys me. I like to have it all nicely and in order so that I can present nice, clean, neat, logical or chronological points that make a lot of sense. But in acrostic psalms, there's often a lot of repetition. So if you know Psalm 119, how many times does that psalm repeat the word of God or the commandments of God or in other language, the same old thing? And it's the same thing with a psalm like this where there's this repetitive concept being repeated over and over and over again about trusting in the Lord. But there is, a general three-point structure that we can see to the psalm. Verses 1 to 11 give us our initial call to not be angry, but to trust in the Lord when evil is prospering. Verses 12 to 24 then go out to contrast the wicked, their deeds, and the outcomes of their deeds, with the righteous, their deeds, and the outcomes of their deeds. And then the last part of the psalm, verses 25 to 40, this last part of the psalm is the time-tested exhortations of an old man. If you look down at verse 25, what does it say? I have been young and now I'm old yet. And so here we have a man who has lived by the promises of God. He's trusted in the Lord. And now speaking from experience, he wants to assure you that everything that he's been saying up to this point are tested and true. And so the last part of the psalm is David reflecting on a long life of trusting in the Lord and the wonderful outcome of that. So there's a lot of gold here, but we're not going to be concerning ourselves with the majority of the psalm. We'll be looking at verses 1 to 11. So we've looked at the opening, verse 1 to 2. Let's look now at the first exhortation in verse 3. Verse 3 is the first response on our part. What are you to do when evil prospers? What to do in the place of our default response of anger and anxiety? It says, trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness. What was the opening song we sang tonight? Trust and obey. Now you know where they got it from. That's what it's all about. Trust and obey. So in the first place, we are called to turn our eyes away from what? We're called to turn our eyes away from the dumpster fire that is this earth, and to turn our eyes upward to the Lord. That's where we have to begin. When the world is crowding in on you, when everything just seems so bad, what is the first instinct? Where is the first place we should be turning? Trust in the Lord. And what happens when we do that? What do we see when we look at our God? Who is our God? What is our God? We believe in a God who is all-powerful, whose good purposes will prevail, who is a righteous judge, who cannot be dethroned or his purposes frustrated, a God who keeps his promises, who has promised to be with us, who is able to work all things together for good, and we could go on and on. Trust in that God. Turn your eyes away from this world and turn your eyes towards that God. This is the call of the psalmist. And so where our temptation is to take our eyes off of God and our problems to loom large in our minds, and this leading us to extreme emotion and desperate acts, we're called to trust and to do good. Because one of the things that stops happening when we get angry and anxious and consumed because we're looking for some sort of activism. I've got to do something to stop the evil, as if I were God and God is relying on me and he can't make his plans come to pass without me. I stop doing that which he has called me to do, dwelling in the land in faithfulness. And I get caught up with all of these other political activistic sort of things. And all of my energy and all of my efforts go spent in the wrong direction. But the psalm says, no, don't stop being holy. Don't give up on your integrity. Don't give up on your honesty. Don't give up on being a good tax-paying citizen. Don't give up on your civility. Don't give up on being respectful towards others. Don't give up on your law-keeping. Don't give up on your self-control. Dwell in the land and do good. Don't take your sight off of those basic things that the Lord requires of you. The temptation when we see injustice is to resort to taking matters into our own hands and using the world's weapons to secure our futures. I'm not saying that you should not worry about the state of the world, or that you should not pray about the state of the world, nor that you should not utilize your democratic opportunities to be the best citizen that you can, nor that you should neglect using lawful means to bring about a good outcome in society. Do all those things. But it's how you do them that is the concern of the psalm. The basic issue here is that, do you really believe that God is in control, that his plan is coming to pass, that he will finally prevail, and that the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God? Are your emotions and your desire to act in line with God's plan, or are you gearing for war? Are we automatically drawn to those who are putting on their swords and raising the battle cry to rally for action, or do we know that God is in control and will prevail? There are actions that we can do, but our primary action, our primary task as Christians, is to fulfill the Great Commission, which we do in connection with the church. So we are to pray, and we can add to that a number of positive things that we ought to do as good citizens. I'm not saying do nothing, don't misunderstand me, but I'm asking you this: are you acting like those who don't have God in their lives? Are you resorting to those political tactics? Those political weapons. Do you have the same emotional angst and desperate need to respond in kind to the evil that we see is all around us? Is it keeping us so distracted that we cannot think about anything else, and even our walk with the Lord and our involvement in the church is suffering because we're caught up in a different mission? We're taken up with a different cause. We have no emotions left for those things that are on the heart of God. Do we have a view of the future that seems so hopeless that perhaps you're even saying to yourself these sorts of words, raising children in a world like ours is now impossible? It's not true. But let's look at the next thing that we're called to do, verse 4. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. We move from the problem of where we are putting our confidence in to where we find our treasure. And I find this very interesting, that David sees our anger over evil as a worship problem. Our anger over evil is a worship problem. How is anger against evil a worship problem? Well, when we place our treasure in the things of this world, and the things of this life, when our lives here and now are so important to us that God is marginalized, and the future that he has laid up for us is no longer looming large in our minds and informing our emotions, we then react badly whenever they are threatened. We know how it goes. We protect what we love, and we will fight to the death for that which is most precious to us. Are we delighting in the world, or are we delighting in the Lord and the future that he has guaranteed for us? This life can loom so large in our hearts that any threat to it causes an instinctive defensiveness. This is not evil in itself. You're supposed to be troubled by injustice. You wouldn't be a Christian if you weren't. You're supposed to be, in some sense, angry. You know, it would be wrong if you were unfeeling. But there is an anger over injustice when we are experiencing it personally that can destroy us because God is not our treasure. The anger to not getting too angry and sinning is not a cultivated indifference. No, we must never decide that evil is not evil. You should always be disturbed at evil. Of course you must. We must not self-deceive in order to try and get a handle on our emotions. Feel deeply about that injustice. See it for what it is. And as Christians, we often have the clearest view and the most visceral response to lies and injustice in our society today. But when God is your God, when God is your treasure and your portion, how different your response will be. You will not be governed by that anger and drawn into desperation and terrible places by that anger. Remember Psalm 73. There is Asaph in Psalm 73, and he's wrestling with the problem: why do good things happen to bad people and why do bad things happen to good people? He is struggling over the evil in the world, and he has an encounter with his God, and he sees God for who he is in Psalm 73, verse 25 and 26. And this is what he says, some of my favorite verses in the Bible. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. You see, here was a man who was ready to become an atheist and to walk away from his God because of the terrible things that were happening in his own life and in society. But then when he saw how God was not letting go of his hand, when he saw the grace of God towards him, even though he was being beastly and stupid, even though he was raging in his heart and God was being faithful to him, the accusations against God's goodness, the discontent with his present difficulties, they all melted away in his love for a good and gracious God. Because God became his delight. God became his treasure. And suddenly all of those things which were frustrating him melted away. Turn your eyes upon Jesus and the things of this world will grow strangely dim. We sing about that often, don't we? That's the experience here. But when we find ourselves obsessed with the news, unable to look away from the dumpster fire of this world, the last thing we want to do at that time is draw near to God. Yet this is the very thing that we need to do to find that contentment which our hearts need in this moment. In fact, David tells us that it is then that we will receive all of our heart's desires. What does he mean by this? When you delight yourself in the Lord, then you'll receive the desires of your heart. This is not some sort of secret switch that we get all of our selfish desires fulfilled with. David's not telling us you'll get every sinful desire of your heart. No, David is telling us that when we love God and delight in God, our hearts, our very hearts will be changed and shaped and begin to want the right things. It goes something like this. There you are, you are discontent. You're even critical of God and questioning God because there's so much injustice in your life and the lives of others. You can't imagine why he would not do anything about it. You seem more just, more righteous, more indignant at sin than God. Then, like Asaph in Psalm 73, you encounter God. And that encounter reminds you of your sin, of your unworthiness, of his love, yet he loves you. In fact, he gives Christ to save you. He has adopted you as a child into his family, and he has secured a future and eternal happiness in his presence forever. Suddenly, the realities of the gospel are more gripping than the audio-visual drama of the slugfest, which is the culture wars. You realize that this God has a plan, that he has a plan that involves everything in your life and this world. He has a plan that is from his wisdom, which is always perfect and good, and it's all for his glory, and now you're faced with a choice. Do you choose the world that you think should exist and hold on to your anger and your zealotry for the cause? Or do you want the plan that God has for you, which may include suffering, injustice, persecution, being marginalized, and being the underdog as the people of God? Which one will you choose? Your heart has been reminded that God is better than you ever realized. And so your heart naturally goes, God can do no wrong. God can only will what is right. All that God chooses for me, I accept and I submit. And anything he wants for me, I now want. And you get the desires of your heart that way. Now, there's a little bit of a difference of opinion here. Some take this verse to mean that if we desire God first, trust and obey, then one day we'll get what our hearts want. But I think that the psalmist is calling us to present heart surgery, not future heart fulfillment. I think that's what he's holding out here in this wonderful verse. Let's look at the next thing. Verses 5 and 6. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in him and he will act. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your justice as the noonday. The commentators tell us that the idea of commit means to roll over onto. To roll over onto the Lord. The idea here is the same as 1 Peter 5 verse 7. Casting all your anxieties on him because he cares for you. David, in these verses, is calling us to trusting prayer. Put it before the Lord. Cast it upon the Lord. Take it off your shoulders and roll it onto the only shoulders who can bear the weight of the world. This is what David is encouraging. The act of prayer is often far from us when we are consumed with unbelieving anger. And what's in front of us is so emotionally provocative, we don't pray. But David calls us to prayer. He is calling us to the corrective tonic of prayer. But not just prayer, waiting and patient prayer. David urges us to trust God. He assures us God will act. And we often need this reassurance because when we are full of righteous indignation, we want action now. We want to see those results now. It's got to be now. Our emotions call for action. We want instant response. But David calls us to patient and waiting prayer. God is just. He will not overlook injustice. God does love us and he does hear our prayers, but there may be a wait. There may be a wait. And let's look at our age and think about the wait that we have before us. Our wait might be until the next age. We are not guaranteed justice in this age, though we are finally promised justice. If we use David's reference to our righteousness in these verses, in the Old Testament, this would have manifested in David being vindicated by God, even though Saul or Absalom were trying to kill him. For us, our wait is much like Christ's. It's only going to be on the other side of the resurrection. It was then that Christ was vindicated. It was then that he was shown to be the Son of God with power. The church is hated now and at times might be shown to be a light and in the truth, but we cannot give up hope if we have no vindication in this life. Christ even prepared us for this sort of wait. The world will hate us. All those who seek to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution, but the meek shall inherit the earth. And so we come to our final exhortation. Be still before the Lord. Look at verse 7. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Fret not yourself over the one who prospers in his way, over the man who carries out evil devices. One of the things we do when we are incensed at injustice is begin to preach the law. Oh, that is so wrong. The law comes out. We like to talk about justice and injustice. In order to stir the righteous emotions of our anger towards sin, we linger on the law. There is an endless rhetoric as we wax lyrical about the terrible things that are going on around us. And we go on and on and on and on and on about how bad it all is. And by this, what do? We work ourselves up into a frenzy. And so, compare that inner diatribe with this command. be still before the Lord. Fret not yourself. Why does it say yourself there? Why doesn't it just say fret not? Why does it say fret not yourself? Because who's stirring the pot? You're stirring your own pot by the way in which you're constantly parading the wrong of the thing before your eyes. But it is unjust. But it is terrible. It does deserve judgment. Do you feel nothing? Be still. Fret not yourself. There is a time when we have seen the power and the sovereignty and the goodness of God that to insist on our anger, to insist on a frenetic activity that tries to take things into its own hands will become a denial of God and a living by sight and not by faith. So you can see this. Think about David. Just put yourself back in his past. David had been anointed king by Samuel. Saul now wanted to kill him in his jealousy. Who was right, David or Saul? David. So Saul takes his daughter back. You will no longer be his wife. Saul takes the generalship that had been bestowed upon David as a man in good standing in the army, takes that away. Saul takes away David's reputation, takes that away. Saul takes away his house. Saul takes away his security. Saul takes away every single thing that he ought to have, and he is the anointed promised king of Israel. And then Saul goes into a cave to relieve himself. And there is David with an opportunity to kill Saul. What does he do? He waits. He waits upon the Lord. And he, just imagine every night, David is lying on his bed, his head's on his pillow, and he's just, Saul's done this to me. 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 He is so tempted to anger all the time. All he wants to do is grab that sword and rush in there and kill somebody. This is the advice coming from David. Fret not yourself. Look at the next verses, verse 8 and 9. Refrain from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not yourself. It tends only to evil, for the evildoers shall be cut off. But those who wait for the Lord shall inherit the land. I could put a lot of words down here about the destructive power of our anger, how it destroys ourselves and others, and how it criticizes God and makes a target of our neighbor. But I just want us to linger on this whole process of just being still, being quiet. Turn in your Bibles to Psalm 131. I think we have here a wonderful psalm. And just try this sometime. Here is a psalm that is a living embodiment of what it means to be quiet before God. Psalm 131. O Lord, my heart is not lifted up. So imagine a man who's angry, a man who wants his questions answered, a man who's trying to understand the big picture, and he's fretting himself. Lord, my heart is not lifted up. My eyes are not raised too high. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me. But I have calmed and quieted my soul like a weaned child with its mother. Like a weaned child is my soul within me. O Israel, hope in the Lord from this time forth and forevermore. What's this man doing? What's the psalm showing us here? That quiet. Now, there's a lot in the therapeutic world of wellness today that advocates a technique of quieting yourself and calming yourself. Well, the Bible predates all that stuff. It's true that our souls need calm, but our thoughts need to be taken captive to the truth and not just manipulated with technique. And that's why the psalmist calls you to put your hope in the Lord. You're not just doing mental tricks to cause emotional states. by not thinking about certain things, but by putting your hope in the Lord, so that now, like a child in its mother's arms, with no cares in the world, fully fed, and all it wants to do is doze off with not a care in the world, that is you in the arms of God. And you can just trust in Him. Like a weaned child. The carefree confidence of a child that knows that their loving parent will take care of it all. This is the rest that we can have in God. We cannot have it in anything else, but if we are believers, we can have it in God. Then look at our final verses, verses 10 and 11. In just a little while, the wicked will be no more. Though you look carefully at his place, he will not be there. But the meek shall inherit the land and delight themselves in abundant peace. In these final words, we are being reminded of where we started. We are pointed to the final destiny of all that wickedness which is irking our souls. David would have experienced in his time an eschatological intrusion. He would have seen in a physical way what we will one day see on Judgment Day. So he had his Judgment Day brought forward, and he saw the wicked Saul fall upon his own sword. That's the wonderful thing about verse 14 and 15. The wicked fall upon their own sword. Who fell upon his own sword? Who fell by his own sword? Saul. David saw the day of the wicked being judged. We wait for the day of the wicked being judged. But technically speaking, no matter how long we have to wait in time, in light of eternity, is always just a little while, according to the words of this text. It's always just a little while, because one day in 1,000 years, they're the same to the Lord. What the everything of this life is a light, momentary affliction compared to eternity. And then when Jesus comes again, then the meek will inherit the earth. We will not, as the post-millennialists tell us, cultivate the earth and make it by our theonomic strategies, the kingdom of God now. We're going to inherit it. You know what inheritance is? Someone gives it to you as a gift. You don't earn it. It's a blessing. It's given. You don't work for it. And then we have this wonderful word, meek. This word, meek, best describes the attitude that is encouraged in this psalm. Meekness does not mean weakness. We all know that. We've all heard that before. It means to be gentle in the face of evil, humble towards those who are persecuting us. It also means not giving way to anger, but waiting patiently and in faith and faithfulness. Even while we're being persecuted, even while we're being marginalized, even while we're being mistreated, waiting upon God to deliver. Meekness means those who do good to those who harm us. Good despite the fact that people persecute us for it, submitting ourselves to the mighty hand and plan of God, even if it includes suffering. So friends, how do we respond when the evil all around us are prospering and the evil man seems to be able to carry out all his schemes and plans? Read Psalm 37, verse 1 to 11. It is a word in season. Let's pray.